It's looking distinctly un-Mexican in here. Can anybody tell me where Effie's gone? Any ideas, Andrew?
Is he down in the supermarket buying fresh chilies, not chili powder?
But actual fresh chili. Could be. That could be one option. John?
I thought he quit and started teaching salsa classes.
Or for cheaper than £5.
Yeah, yeah. I hear he's doing it for food, for chilies.
He told me he had to write an important email to Alex Salmon about Scottish independence, so...
Good for him, good for him. Well, hopefully he will be back again in a couple of weeks. This is episode 9 of season 3 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Jonathan Roberts.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Excellent. And in this episode, we'll be talking about David Braben's mini PC, Matt Zimmerman leaving Canonical. We've got our discoveries, our You Dare Us challenge, which didn't actually exist, Speak Your Brains, and of course the open ballot. If you love this podcast, you will absolutely, totally love Linux Format Magazine, which we work so hard on every month.
We do.
Yep, and you can subscribe to that at tuxradar.com/subscribe. This is the news. So we've probably all seen that David Braben of Elite and Frontier fame and the man who writes millions of lines of awesome assembly code is...
Any excuse for you to talk about Braben.
I love Frontier. He's come up with the Raspberry Pi Foundation, which exists to promote the study of computer science and related topics.
That's a terrible
name. It is a bit strange, isn't it?
I quite like it.
But when I think of a Raspberry, I don't think of small USB computers.
No, but it does make me like salivate and feel a little hungry.
That makes me think of Prince.
Prince?
Prince. Old Raspberry Beret.
Yeah.
Like there's a girl and she's just wearing a little USB plug-in hat.
And it seemed like you were busy doing something next to nothing, but different than the day before.
Well, maybe it's the fruit theme, you know, Apple's popular, so maybe wants to capture some of that. But yeah, wants to promote the study of computer science and related topics, especially at school level, and to put the fun back into learning computing.
So, I think it's a brilliant idea.
I think it's a great idea. We all started learning to program on like Spectrums and Commodore 64s and the like, when computers were really, really simple. There wasn't a lot you could do. So,
did you have computers at your school? When you were doing GCSEs, when you were like 12 or 13?
Yes, we had a bunch of Macs, Mac Classics in one department and a bunch of PCs on the other, which we used a DOS.
You were allowed to use them then? Because we had a computer lab that we weren't allowed to use. No one was allowed to use them. It was special.
Well, why did
I don't
it
know.
Exist?
I don't know. I don't know.
Hmm.
In middle school, we had Acorn Archimedes that we were all allowed to use for an hour... I think it was an hour a week.
Wow.
And there was some game on there about dragons and, you know, you have a potion, do you throw it at the dragon? Yes, no, and you just had to go
I think
through
I remember this game.
Oh, yeah.
It was in a BBC.
It's Granny's Garden.
That's what we had.
Granny's Garden.
The first game I've ever played.
That was it.
We played at school, and if you're listening, Bob Marr, you remember all the times we played that as kids. yeah, Granny's Garden.
I never played it.
No.
I don't think I played it.
Yeah, there was something, and you had lollipops as well, different coloured dragons with different coloured lollipops.
Let me write that down. I can't touch the table.
Write it down in your head.
It's all right, I think.
Look it up on Google / Bing / whatever later.
But yeah, I guess the point was that whatever we did, one of the things we did on the BBCs in our computer classes were just drawing lines.
Yeah. With a turtle program.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Which the guy who did, is it Guido van Rossum, whatever, he's redone it and... He's rewritten it. I can't think what it's called, though. Like a teaching programming language.
What? So he's combined what Python and Logo? Is it nothing to do with Python?
I'm not sure. Sorry, that's a completely useless piece of information.
Huh? Well, it's interesting that... Did you do that, then? I mean, considering the difference, there must be like 15 years or more between when we did it.
Yeah, we definitely did it, yeah.
Well, that's quite good, because what I was going to say is, at least at that low level, you do I guess this is what Braben's getting at, understanding the bits and bytes, something of what happens, rather than it just being a magical black box.
Yeah, it must be impossible now to get, for a young person, to get to grips with exactly what is going on in a modern PC. There's so much hardware. So many different components of an operating system and the hardware itself. Whereas, you go back to your Spectrum C64, you knew that machine, you knew what every byte was doing if you wanted to. So this is going to be, hopefully, it's going to be on sale for around $25, around £15. And Brabham, or the foundation, says, we plan to develop, manufacture and distribute this ultra low cost computer for use in teaching computer programming to children. We expect this computer to have many other applications, both in the developed and the developing world. The specifications are understandably pretty small. 700 megahertz ARM chip, 128 megs of RAM, one HDMI port and one USB port. So the thing is about the size of a thumb drive
from
the prototypes. I mean, you know, we were learning computing on 7 megahertz Amiga, so 700 megahertz is still ridiculously fast in comparison.
If it's got a HDMI port, does that mean it's capable of high definition output?
Could possibly be. I don't know what kind of graphics hardware they've got.
Because that's pretty impressive.
Presumably. I guess it's convenient. I mean, it's no different to a DVI port per
sound. No,
it might just be the easiest way of doing it.
True.
It might not mean that it's high definition.
But I've contacted them because I want to try and get an interview for the magazine and to talk to David Brabham about Frontier.
And a geek desktop.
Whoa. Oh, that'd be awesome, yeah.
David, if you're listening, two things. Can you get in touch with us and we can sort out an interview? And secondly, is there really a black hole in the middle of the universe? You said this ages ago and nobody's found it yet. Thanks.
Another thing, I want to know whether he's 45 or 46.
Oh, yeah.
Wikipedia says 45 to 46.
To 46. David Brabham is so cool. He can just be two ages at once.
He's like Samoa. He spans state lines.
Next up in the news, Matt Zimmerman is leaving Canonical after 7 years.
He was one of the founding members, wasn't he, of the Canonical management team?
He was, yeah, and he's been CTO for 7 years. He says, the time is right for me to move on from this role where I enjoy so much support from my colleagues and take a risk on something new. He says that he wants to remain involved in the Ubuntu community. So I don't think it's a...
No, I mean, 7 years is a long time. I mean, I'd have been on Linux format for 7 years.
And... Oh, I'm sorry.
I can totally sympathise with how he feels.
It doesn't seem to be a bad-natured split or anything. He seems to be going in good spirit, so he's probably just looking for something new.
Yeah, probably.
Or
maybe he's not happy in the direction Ubuntu is going. Maybe
it'd be interesting if he turns up at another distro.
Yeah.
Yeah, or another Linux company.
If he turns up at Linux Mint.
Yes. Whoa.
I think you're right, though. I think you're right.
Hmm.
I doubt there's anything more to it.
There's another interesting piece of Ubuntu news that John reminded me about this morning, that the Ubuntu Developer Conference is going on at the moment in Budapest, and Mark Shuttleworth there has said he wants to have 200 million Ubuntu users in 4 years. Now, the guesstimates around the net seem to be that Ubuntu's got around 10 to 15 million users. So that's an absolutely massive growth rate. He's hoping for 200 million.
He must have
users.
A plan. There must be some developing nations plan where he's going to stick the new Unity Ubuntu on tiny little computers. And he must know something, because otherwise that's just an insane idea.
I don't think you're just going to get that organically through market.
All it would take would be some sort of deal with the education department of Guangzhou province or something. And then
Which there, it would be done. Brilliant if that's the case, if that's going on in the background. Also, in 6 months' time, we'll be able to say, well, you know, have you got 25 million extra users? No, by October. And we can say, no, you haven't, Mark. What are you doing?
Yeah, you're right. It must be some big contract. It can't just be a loan like they've got a plan with Dell to start shipping Ubuntu machines again, because they've already tried that and it didn't seem massively successful. So, like you say, it might be one of those BRIC countries that's going to fully sign up to Linux, deploy it across the whole country.
Which would be brilliant. Maybe that's why they've developed Unity. Maybe they're touch devices.
Could well be. But even then, Unity still doesn't seem perfectly suited to touch devices.
No.
You've still got little fiddly widgets everywhere. I think you've got to go back.
That's true, yeah.
Start from scratch.
Logging out is going to be a bit difficult.
Meanwhile, Attachmate, the company that bought up Novell a few months ago, has apparently fired most or all of its US-based Mono developers. They issued a statement that said, we have re-established Nuremberg in Germany as the headquarters of our SUSE business
that
unit.
A bit scary.
And the prioritization and resourcing of certain development efforts, including Mono, will now be determined by the business unit leaders there. So they may offer to move some Mono staff to Nuremberg from the USA. But they said, This change will lead to the release of some US-based employees today. I like the way that a company can fire people and say they're releasing them.
Yeah, like they've been held in bondage for the last few years. You're free to go now.
You're free to have no money.
Someone set them free.
I mean, it's not a massive news story in itself, but we're all intrigued to see what exactly is going to happen with Novell's assets and SUSE after being taken over by Attachmate, a company that none of us had really heard anything about before.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't had a chance to look whether Miguel de Caza has posted anything in response to the news.
I haven't seen anything.
Because, I mean, Mono actually has quite a lot of forward momentum, especially on different platforms.
Yeah, on like iOS and Android as well.
Yeah, and iOS 10 as well now. So it seems to me that probably with or without Attachmate/Novell, Mono is probably going to carry on.
I think Microsoft's been like giving them some backing as well with it, like getting them into conferences and improving the runtime and stuff, so...
And also, those developer skills are easily transferable to the most popular language on the planet, .NET C#.
It's true, yeah. And John makes an interesting point there as well. I mean, far be it for me to ever say anything nice about Microsoft, because I still find it hard to trust them. But lots of naysayers thought by now Mono had been destroyed and we'd all have been sued and paying millions of license fees for having anything C# in Linux. And yeah, Microsoft seems to have played ball pretty well so far.
But at the same time, that was because it was under the umbrella of Novell and its secret patent indemnity agreements with Microsoft. So maybe that might change.
Yeah, whether that's transferred across to Attachmate as well.
I don't think so. I think Microsoft now has bigger fish to fry. I don't think they're bothered about Mono.
I wouldn't think so. They're battling Google and Apple, aren't they?
And buying Skype.
Yes.
And buying Skype. So
$8 billion.
But I heard that Skype's never actually made a profit. Ever.
It made like it was only a 7 million loss it made.
Right.
This year, which is pretty minor.
And it's 100 million plus users or something, isn't it? It's a big number.
So it's nothing compared to what Windows Live has and what their Windows communications technologies already have.
And hasn't that got VoIP stuff in it?
Yeah. It makes, like all of the analysis I've seen, it makes no sense as far as I can tell. I don't understand it.
But Skype is the bigger brand, isn't it? Skype has now become a verb.
It is, you're right. And I know lots of people who use it.
So you're paying $8 billion for a brand?
For a really strong global brand, yeah.
Maybe.
Which they can probably bundle in with the next version of Windows Mobile.
Yeah.
Get some advertising on there.
Suppose if they put Skype and like peer-to-peer telephony onto the Windows Mobile platform, that would be incredible. No carrier would ever let them do it.
No, that's the problem, isn't it? The carriers hate this kind of stuff because it stops people paying for phone calls.
I've never been a big fan of Skype just because of the proprietary protocols it uses. I mean, SIP is much better for lots of things.
One of the questions is whether or not the Linux version of Skype will continue now, whether Microsoft will back it. And I mean, you know, if Microsoft does stop making it, there'll be a lot of cries of, oh, they're trying to destroy Linux. But if Skype doesn't actually make any money and Linux has 1-2% desktop market share, it might not be even worth their time having a team devoted to it anyway on Linux.
So. You know, fortunately, if they ever abandon Skype, you can just buy the next issue of Linux Format to find out how to set up your own asterisk box and you're fine.
That's ace. That's
who,
issue.
Who would dare take on such a challenge, though? That's what I don't understand.
Some fool.
It's now time for Discovery of the Week. This is where we talk about interesting things that we've found that have made our lives easier or harder or just more livable in. How have you lot got on?
I've got two.
Two?
Yeah. Although they're not really Linux related, unfortunately.
Are they both David Braben related?
One is.
Or Jeff Crammon related. The guy that did Formula One GP.
Another brilliant assembly language programmer. My first one is a website URL, and it's www.no.com. That's N with 15 O's. Just go to it and see what happens. Yes, and the second one is about Frontier, but it's how to run it on Linux, so I guess it is about Linux. That you can run it on DOSBox. You can get Frontier from the Frontierverse website.
Is it legally downloadable? Is it because Ian Bell made it available for a while, didn't he?
Well, Ian Bell had nothing to do with Frontier.
Oh, no, of course not. Yeah,
so you're right. There was some confusion over Elite.
Yes, yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
And some of the ships from Elite are used in Frontier, so I think that's been a bit of a source of which obviously, but you can download Frontier from Frontierverse website and then run it in DOSBox. And I found on my Intel Core 2 Duo 2.1 gigahertz box that 24,000 CPU cycles is perfectly right to make it nice and crispy and creamy smooth.
So if you're worried about copyright, then do you have to avoid using the Cobra Mark 1?
Yeah, avoid the Cobra Mark 1 and don't go to Lave.
Don't get chased by police, I guess.
Yeah, don't go to Lave either, or ReadQuat or any of those other systems, which is pretty cool.
Are there still the Corollis space stations in Frontier?
The little box ones.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Don't go to those places either.
Just go to the big ones like Mikhail Gorbachev and
Li Qingzhao. It doesn't seem to exist. You know, there's Abraham Lincoln, Mikhail Gorbachev space stations, but Li Qingzhao, and I don't know what that is.
Maybe they were just. Sorry, Graham.
No, it is very interesting.
But anyway.
Andrew, got anything?
Yeah, my discoveries. I too have been playing.
Good work.
And yes, I too have been playing Frontier. But I think Mike's pretty much covered how epically awesome it is. So yeah. I'll just second, you know, what he's just said. I do have another maybe, I don't know, 0.5 of a discovery and 0.5 of a rediscovery. And that's following comments from the last podcast. I got on YouTube and had a look at some Chris Eubank videos. God, he was good.
He was so good.
That second fight against Carl Thompson, where, you know, Thompson was something ridiculous, like 2 stone heavier and 3 inches taller, and he just pounded him until Thompson, you know, closed Eubank's eye. But Eubank was ahead on all the judges' scorecards because he was just a superb, superb boxer and an amazing entertainer as well. I've got some hastily copied and pasted facts from YouTube.
Cool.
From Wikipedia, sorry. He purchased the title of the Lord of the Manor of Brighton and used the ancient right of this position to appoint a town crier in addition to the town crier employed by the local authority. If the two meet, do they cancel? If the two meet, it's like the Ben v Eubank rematch.
Oh yeah.
Oh yay.
Oh yay.
Simply the best versus the Dark Destroyer. Oh, so good, so good. In 1994, he took over a prime site in the city, which he called Buckingham Place. He knocked down the interior while keeping the Grade 2 facade intact and built 69 flats for the homeless using £1.25 million of his own money.
This guy's awesome.
He eventually went bankrupt, owing £1.3 million. Oh,
no. Didn't he crash his lorry?
He had that big lorry, didn't he? Yeah. Around the country.
Yeah, he got arrested in 2003 for driving around Parliament Square in his enormous truck, which displayed the message, Tony Blair, military occupation causes terrorism.
Whoa.
He was handcuffed and led into a police
car. I like this guy.
He's brilliant.
I don't feel so bad anymore.
Now that we've got him on our podcast.
Monocle, jodhpurs, and just awesome fighting skills. What a man.
Awesome. John, you got anything?
Yeah, I discovered that the at command. Sorry, this is the only Linux-related discovery
I've got
so far.
One. I've
good,
got one.
Good, okay. But the at command, at, on the terminal, it runs commands at a later time that you specify, and you can specify time with keywords like noon or tea time. So tea time is officially usable on your Linux terminal to schedule commands.
That's sort of TEA time.
TEA time, yes.
That's very British.
Yes, yeah. I know. It's wonderful, isn't it?
It is. What time is tea time?
Apparently it's 4 p.m.
4 p.m.
4 p.m. is officially tea time.
Is there things like tiffin as well?
No, I wish maybe I...
Elevenses.
High breakfast.
Second breakfast.
We should fork it, though, and make right. Hobbit, Hobbit at Hobbit time.
We should, you're right.
That's cool.
Start a new distro with it.
Well, my discovery is, thanks to somebody who actually emailed me, I did something on the Dream Plug, which is like a plug computer thing that you plug in. in the last issue. And I've also reviewed Nest boxes in the past, and I'm always complaining that when I plug it into the review network here, I can never get the IP address. It's difficult. I don't know how to do it other than trying to, because we've got a big network here. I'm sure there are better ways into it. But anyway, someone sent me the solution to this problem. It's a solution from Robert Ladyman. And he says you can use the ARP command, which I've never heard of. Yeah. ARP-S, the IP address that you want to assign to a device. So you have to, obviously, even if you're using DHCP, you have to use an address that hasn't been allocated on the same subnet, followed by the MAC address of the device that plug into the network. So with most of these devices, you obviously find the MAC address stuck on as a sticker onto the box.
Yeah.
So ARP-S, the IP address you want to give it, the MAC address of the device, and then it assigns that IP address to the device from your computer.
What, over the network?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And you can connect to the devices from there.
So is it like transcends DHCP or something?
Yeah, it must do.
How does it...
I don't know.
Is it like a pseudo IP address on your computer or something?
It must be. It must be. I haven't actually looked into what actually ARP does. Robert said it's much easier to find the MAC address of the device and use the ARP command, usually as root, with the S and the appropriate parameters to forcibly associate an IP address local to your machine with the device. So it must scan the network for the MAC address somehow. Scan the network for the MAC address and then assign it to a local IP address on your machine. And that's it. You have to make sure that the local adapter is also using that range. But I will find that useful.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the MAN page requires that you already know what an ARP cache is.
So I have to look into it.
And with such ARPing nonsense, we come to the halfway point of this podcast. Still to come, You Dare Us, which isn't really You Dare Us, Speak Your Brains, and of course, the open ballot.
Okay, so it's time for You Dare Us, but last time, we didn't dare ourselves anything, and none of you bothered to dare us with anything. instead of a dare, we are going to look at some of the latest convert stories from Convert Corner on the TuxRadar blog.
Cool, sounds a good idea.
So just a couple, really, and I'll summarize because they're quite long. So the first one is from Mark www.
What a strange name.
Yeah, I know. What was parents thinking?
Maybe he's got a broken keyboard.
So he says that he tried to install Linux about two years ago. He's talking about himself as a convert. Tried to install Linux a few years ago and failed miserably, and has since tried it again. And so either he thinks he's improved a lot or Linux has improved a lot. And he says it was dead simple and he's really happy with it. So
cool. That's
a great bit of context, I think, that in the last 2 years, Linux has improved substantially.
That's good to hear.
Even if it still has its failings, it has improved.
He should have referred to himself as we. We tried Linux's, but it didn't work.
My precious. So yeah, he says it's improved a lot, and I agree with him. I think it is much easier now, which is really cool. And this kind of puts it in context for everyone who's converting people. It's much easier now.
Yeah, if you tried it a few years ago, try it again.
Yeah, and more people can try it now, and you can pass it on to more people and it'd be useful. As these other convert stories will show you. Edric says that he converted his uncle, and he gave a very thorough description about boot times and creating a risk management plan for his uncle and also, because he goes on to reveal that his uncle who he's converted is 90 years old.
Wow.
And he is now using Linux very happily. So, you know, if a 90-year-old can use it, then it goes to show that all our comments about mothers using it are completely irrelevant.
I'm hoping by the time I'm 90, I'll be doing something really elite, like running OpenVMS on a fridge.
F1GP on a fridge.
So there's that one. And then also we have someone else completely other end of the spectrum who set up his kids with a PC so that they didn't use his iMac. which he says is... he assures is running Linux in various VMware environments. But he says he set up his kids with it and they love it. And he offered to reinstall Windows on it for them. But no, they wanted to keep Linux. They love Tux Paint.
Excellent.
And they love Firefox. And they say it's way better than their school's computers. Yeah, so you've got both ends of the spectrum. That is how much Linux has improved in the last 2 years. Got a 90-year-old and we got an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old who can use it, which is pretty cool, I think.
That makes the average age of a Linux user about 40-something. No, probably about 30-something.
I also read another one on there, I don't know how long ago it was, where it was a guy who said some friends had been visiting and they wanted to access their email or the internet.
Oh, yeah, this guy in the outback in Australia something. Yeah, I saw
and
this one.
So he loaned them his Linux machine and they did everything they wanted to do and for half an hour or something. Didn't notice, didn't care. It wasn't important that it was Linux. They said it was great.
Which is exactly what it should be.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Exactly, I think that's the surest sign that you know, because it certainly never used to be like that.
I think the point is with Linux, once you've got it set up and running for somebody, it's very rarely do you have major issues with it. Like it can still be a pain, hardware compatibility and just getting all the kinks worked out and getting it just like you want it to be.
It's a pity more.
Which is why we still have a job.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Okay. Thanks, John.
So we need another challenge. Bit of a tough one. How about we all get together on IRC, all of us and our listeners?
What's IRC?
Internet Relay Chat. It's the hot new thing. It's going to be the successor to Twitter.
Is it like apparently. Skype?
Yeah, but it's like Skype, but you press plastic squares on a box and words appear on the screen.
Plastic squares? I wonder about the touch screens now.
That's a good idea, actually, because we could all use different clients.
Yeah. So what? Yeah.
It's about to be the actual challenge of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Bagsy, Ursi.
Yeah, Ursi's good. XChat. Another good one. I wrote an IRC client once called Tatanga and I hooked it up with the festival speech synthesis software, so it just read out stuff that was happening in my IRC channels in a very robotic voice, and I'm sorry to the guy that hates robot voice.
That's okay.
So yeah, we'll
okay, that's a really good idea. So we'll set up a time and a date.
Yes, let's
we'll all get on IRC with our own clients and you listener can join us if you want to.
So how about irc.freenode.net or whatever Freenode is these days and join #LinuxFormat because I do own the operator rights to that channel. So how about Friday the 20th of May at 1500 hours BST. Does that sound good? 3 o'clock in the afternoon next Friday for us.
Isn't that British summer time?
Yep.
That's what you just said, isn't it?
Yeah. That's what we are, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
1500 hours BST.
Let's do it.
Friday the 20th of May.
Okay, well, I'll put it in the notes, and if we change it, I'll put it in the notes.
So, yeah, come and join us, listeners. Hop onto IRC. IRC is dead easy to use. There are loads of guides if you never used it before. Join Freenode, #LinuxFormat channel, and we'll be there for lots of merriment and fun. And then you can suggest us some more challenges, some real challenges. All right, then, Speak Your Brains is still alive. Magically, we all thought it was going to die.
Did we get some responses then over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I've still had more emails coming in, most of which are far, far too long to actually read out in full, so I've had to ruthlessly edit
them. Well, it's good that people have put that effort into it.
Yeah, we do appreciate it. I think Speak Your Brains is a good idea for a section, so thanks for getting in touch, people. Eddie in Aberdeen says, where the hell can I buy a new preloaded Linux laptop? My aging desktop PC is great but slow, and I'd like to get a laptop replacement, i.e. not a netbook or tablet, a machine that will run any major distro with good performance. A wireless laptop would be more suited to my home life, freeing me from the study and allowing the PC to be used more socially around the house. However, there does not seem to be anywhere in the UK I could just buy one. Dell used to, but don't seem to anymore, and as far as I know, that just leaves the Linux Emporium. I know nothing about them, and there doesn't seem to be much on the internet to allow me to make a decision on their quality.
That's a good point. And didn't we bring this up recently, that somebody mentioned Linux Emporium? And I got in touch with Linux Emporium and said, can you send us some stuff? And they said that we're changing premises, but when we've moved premises, we will send you some stuff. So I guess we can't really say.
I've had really good results with Linux Emporium in the past, but that was many years ago now. The last time I probably got anything from them was more than 5 years ago. But the people, well, the guy working at the time seemed really passionate, pro-Linux, you know, he really wanted to make a go of it.
John's got a really great laptop that I've been really impressed with. What is it?
Yeah, it's a Toshiba R630, 13R. And it runs out of the box. Everything works.
Brilliant.
And it seems like a really good laptop.
It's a nice laptop. Yeah. And it's kind of... It doesn't feel that much different to a MacBook Air. I think if you compare it in the shops, and it costs probably about a quarter for price.
How much? Do you mind?
It was 450. I did get it on sale. It was a great sale. It was down from about 600.
Is it?
And what's the CPU in it?
It's a Core i3, and it's got an Intel 4500 graphics chip.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's a great laptop.
Yeah, it's got a built-in DVD drive. It's small. It's nice to carry around. I love it. It's fantastic.
I guess the big question a lot of listeners will be asking is, can you get it without Windows, though?
You can't get it without Windows, at least not as far as I know.
Right.
But, you know, just suck it up and write to Toshiba and tell them that you've just wiped Windows off it to put Linux on, and maybe they'll actually pay attention. And
Yeah,
I'll try the whole Windows refund thing. It seems to work for some people some of the time. So if you definitely don't want any Windows on there, yeah, don't sign anything. Don't even boot up the Windows EULA nonsense.
Just make sure that when you get it, Dixon's give you the password or Curry's. I bought it from Dixon's Curry's. What's it called now? Curry's Digital.
Yeah.
And it was like it was the off the shelf model. Like it was end of line or whatever. I don't think end of the line, but you know, if they hadn't any more stock.
Yeah, there'll be something to replace it probably the same spec.
But they had a password on it, didn't give me the password, couldn't reboot, couldn't do anything.
Was it the BIOS password or?
Do you know, good question. I'm not sure, but yeah. I couldn't do anything until I
got the password.
Yeah.
What was the password that Curry's Digital uses?
Oh, no. I should have written it down.
So much fun.
Should have written it down.
Mike OS. Dylan Coakley talks about problems with Ubuntu. He says, since Ubuntu 10.10, I'm experiencing full system freezing. Even control backspace doesn't work. You must be talking about control alt backspace there, but that was taken away,
wasn't it? Removed a while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think rather annoyingly. He says, it's still not fixed on 11.04. Many other people also have the same problem. I wouldn't say Linux has rock solid stability anymore. Pulse audio still causes problems. 5% of, 5% of the time it crashes after logging in and causes system freeze ups with every application. Try explaining to your mom it's the sound system causing Firefox to crash. On the plus side, I can at least play games now because of the open source driver, thanks to the developers. I actually think Unity is good, and I just wish I could minimize apps by clicking on the icon in the Unity launch instead of the minimize button on the app window. 11.0 for performance is rocking. It's pretty sad to read that Pulse Audio is still causing people problems. That is must be one of the most plagued pieces of software in the world.
Yes, it's just we've said it all before, it's just so complicated.
Yeah. Somebody did a diagram of the Linux sound stack, didn't they, of like ALSA and ARTS and OSS and Pulse Audio, and you know how you still get choppy sound out of some games emulators.
It is something that OS X does really, really well with Core Audio.
Yeah.
And the fact that Core Audio is on iOS devices as well, it means that you write one app using Core Audio and you can port it to anything.
I think the technology is there in the Linux world as usual. There's great technology there and great code. It just somebody needs to come along and just simplify it.
It lacks a vision, which is what Mark Shuttleworth was trying so hard to do with Ubuntu, but I don't think they ever pull it off, really.
No.
Yeah, that's true. It needs that one directing force. And finally, Gwilym Creeper says, I just discovered Google Trends. After typing random things into it, I decided to use it for something useful. I typed in Ubuntu and found that the number of people typing Ubuntu into Google search peaks after every release. Nothing interesting there. But I noticed that the interest in Ubuntu seems to be dropping. The biggest peak was when 7.10 was released. After that, the number of searches decreases, and 11.04 has very few. This seems to be the general trend for all Linux distros, except for Linux Mint.
I think he's right. I think Linux is in a bit of a downward trend. I think since 10 years ago when we all thought it, when beating Windows on the desktop was important, all that seems like old news, you know, that everything has changed. And I think what we're talking about there is Linux on desktop machines, really. It's what people are looking for. I think it's becoming marginalized. I don't know what the solution is.
I think the solution is two competing, really, really kick-ass new desktop environments.
Fortunately, we've got three now.
Well, it's four. It's really going to shake it up. I mean, for ages, I've thought that the only real difference between distros was the package manager, because you can always install. You can install KDE on Ubuntu. You can install everything on everything. But now that there's clear blue water now between Mint and between Ubuntu and between Fedora. And
their distinctive distribution.
But do you think that actually helps it to, like, if people aren't, I assume people who are using it aren't searching, say, Ubuntu, whatever. So if it's declining, it's new users coming to look for it. is that going to result in more new users looking for it? Or?
I think there are fewer and fewer people using Linux.
You think there are actually fewer people using it?
Distributions, yeah. I mean, there are more and more using Android and those kind of devices. But yeah, I think so. That's my gut feeling. I don't think it's growing.
I think on the obviously it must be on the enterprise side of things, like desktop and server.
Yeah. Linux. But otherwise, in terms, they probably don't count for much in terms of numbers.
No, especially not searches on Google.
If we can get Linux into schools, you know, and into local government, it would make a hell of a difference.
The real question is, though, does it matter? Because the reason I'm interested in Linux and I care about this stuff is I think it's important from the point of view of freedom. I think, you know, people who live in China and places need to know that the software they're using isn't tracking them.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe people in the UK in the future, having that option there for people is what's important. Mm. Having the option to share software with people who can't afford it, or, you know, to deploy stuff like Asterisk, which is industrial strength stuff, you know, in a small charity or something for a really useful purpose. It's all really useful and it's really fantastic. But as long as that's there, and even if it's a bit geeky and not many people are using it, as long as enough people are using it to keep it a reasonable option.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
But that's all I care about. And people are always going to be developing it as a hobby, and because of these sorts of reasons, I don't think it's ever going to go away. And if less people are using it, then kind of say what?
Yeah, no, I think it's a very good point. You know, yeah.
Well, that's how I feel. That's cool. My speak your brains.
Yay!
Come on, chaps, let's fight against this oppressive non-functioning air conditioning and try and wake ourselves up for the peak, the pinnacle of excitement.
Yeah.
Open ballots!
Yeah!
Yeah! We've broken with tradition by not having a yes or no question and just asked what is Linux's killer feature. So, totting up the replies.
Is yes.
The Linux's killer feature is yes, and now we can all go to the pub. I've got to, before I let you three interject and anything, I've got to give a massive shout out to respondent number one, Paul Gideon Dan, who said, "I think the number one feature that takes Windows users' breath away is Linux does not make your computer get slower over time." Now, we know that this is caused by viruses and Trojans and various things that get installed onto your machine and hog its resources, but your uncle, all he sees is the computer getting slower.
Yes.
So in those terms, that's the most genius, clear-sighted point ever.
True. I mean, one of the worst things about Windows is that after you've used it for a few years and you've put in however many disks and downloaded so many different tools, they all seem to install their own toolbars, their own search helps, their own default this, their own default that, their own little helper applications that run in the little applet bar. You know, even if they're not viruses, it's still clogging your system with a million
and
things.
You don't really know where they've gone. No. They're just bits in the registry and bits in the system folder.
You can never really get rid of them.
Yeah. I think they've made some improvements with that in sandboxing things, but it still looks like, I haven't used Windows in years, but it still looks like a horrendous mess. Yeah. At least you know with a good package manager, for all the faults of package management, you can remove everything in one fell swoop.
Yeah, that is a great feature.
Or get down to PC World and buy another Windows machine for £300 that works for the next 2 or 3 years until it gets really slow. It's just so much of people's money must get just crunched away.
Yeah.
Whenever you're in a shop like that, and I'm always there, I hear people, you know, saying, buying a laptop, and the salesman is like, "Oh, and you should really buy some Mantic antivirus with that." Just say no, don't do it.
Yeah, slow everything down so that you'll have to come back and buy a computer soon.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Or come bring your computer in for a tune-up service for just £59.
But this is exactly when we went to that Ubuntu meeting. This is what they were saying is one of the problems with selling Ubuntu in stores, is they don't have this upsell. They can't get people to come back.
Upsell's where they make all the money as well.
Exactly. So they said this is actually why Ubuntu is not more popular and not on the sales stores.
Yeah, it's nothing nothing to do with how good Ubuntu is or is not. It's how much the salesman can top up the.
Because that's the only reason why they try and sell it to you. And lots of people will accept it. You know, you need... Have you heard about
Everybody
viruses?
Everybody will. Yeah. Oh, no. Like 90%
of viruses. Yeah. How do I not get viruses?
My uncle's terrified of getting viruses. That's a different story.
Yeah. So then, now that we've had the right answer from what's everybody else think?
I think to me it is the community. I think it touches on what John said before, that while we'd like Linux to be more successful, and while we sometimes rant about things hindering that, it does have the best community of any operating system I've seen, of any sizable operating system, because people are using it and developing it and helping one another for the love of it. It isn't entirely driven by financial motive. So it makes me think that every problem we have can be defeated. How long it's going to take is another question. But so the passion of the community, any problem we have in the Linux world can be defeated. I'm really optimistic.
Yeah.
Well, Xavier says that KDE is the killer feature because it's less bloated than Windows and looks cooler.
Yeah, possibly.
No arguments there.
Definitely looks cooler, yeah.
More as a sort of extension of the community point is comes from Harkin. Says
Harkin, was he in Lords of Midnight? Lords of Midnight was one of the characters was Mike Singleton's Lord of Midnight game was a Spectrum 48K game, brilliant game. I think. Or was it Morkin?
He does use a sort of cartoonery thing on his avatar.
It was a brilliant game.
Anyway, Hawkins says, thanks to Freedom, Linux... Actually, no, sorry. Hawkins says, the killer feature is Freedom, with a capital F. Thanks to Freedom, Linux can be translated into dozens of languages. This is by the community. This is I've made the fairly tenuous link. This is really important in places where there is a language used by a minority. For example, I live in a part of Spain, Catalonia, with two official languages. There is much more free software in Catalan than proprietary software. This is something really important for Catalan speakers.
That's brilliant.
And presumably Tagalog speeches. You know, Mexican Spanish, you know, we hear Effie every day saying, oh, you know, I've installed the Mexican Spanish packages for this or that and the other. And it's not just, you know, in the UK, minority languages are very, very much minority, but worldwide, there's loads and loads of people speak languages that aren't English.
I've heard, apparently, like, words.
Graham, have you got any thoughts on...
Well, I'm sure it comes up, but I think the main reason why I started to use Linux... I mean, I agree with community is important, but it's basically the source code is available. Mm. You know, I'm not a brilliant programmer, you know, but I can read code. And what I like is the fact that if I needed to change something, then I could, if I was motivated enough to go and do it, I could do it. And that's really important to me. There are so many times in the past where I used to use Bars and Pipes, which is an old Amiga music sequencing application. And Bars and Pipes was bought by Microsoft, actually. But it was tragic that this brilliant piece of software, this amazing piece of code, which still is now actually a brilliant piece of software, was lost on the world. There's a bit of backstory to that in that the source code was eventually released, but not under a free software license. So you can't actually do anything with it. You can't actually port it to Linux, for example. But just knowing that the source code is there and it can be taken by any of us and changed and turned into something else just gives it all such great, like, stability and security, and means that the time I invest in learning how to use the software and actually using it isn't wasted if it happens to change, or if I want to change it if I prefer it to work in a different way. So the fact that the source is open.
Exactly what Miska says on a piece of paper I've just mislaid. The most important feature for me is that it is open source, so whenever I don't like something, I can go and change it. I wish it would be like it would be that easy in the real world.
Yeah.
And that is true. Somebody else has said that they like it because it's open, and even though they don't have the programming skill to do it, it's great knowing that other people can.
Yeah, because if something bothers you that much, I think you'd actually learn how to program and change it, because you can.
And if you're rich, you can pay someone to do it for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I love being rich.
Yeah.
It's great. Thanks, Mark. Hugh says in his customary contrarian way, yes, no. There are as many killer features as there are people who use Linux. For me, it's the fact that Linux allows me to use my PC in any way I choose. Since the very code that makes up the OS is freely available to hack away at, your only limitation is your own ability or your ability to pay other people. This is where Linux is better than Windows or I whatever. P.S. Please add a shout out to Mr. Saunders for asking two of my questions to RMS.
Oh, I did that, did I?
I thought we paid you to ask RMS questions. Are you just getting other people to come up with questions for you?
Yeah, I actually just went to a pub in London and just left the tape recorder running.
What's really interesting about all these killer features is that, like, besides the speed thing, the slowing down over time, none of them actually say Linux is the better tool for the job. You know, there are all other reasons besides that, which is quite interesting.
What do you reckon then, John?
What do I reckon?
Yeah, what is Linux's killer feature?
Yeah, I agree with Graham and Mike that community and open, you know, the open code and stuff. For all the reasons I said in my little rant earlier, I think it's important. And plus, there's other stuff that I believe about economics and what it is to be human and all of that stuff that I wrote about in my theology degree, but that's, that was my dissertation. My dissertation was on free software. So,
Really?
Yeah, can at least the last chapter. Really, but you can read the first two chapters, a bit on free software, it's terrible. But
You come to the wrong conclusion. Free software sucks.
No, but just no one has ever written about this from like a theological, philosophical point of view. There's so little material to use. It was difficult. But
did you know about what Michael Meeks said about free software?
No.
He got into it because...
Oh, yes. Yeah, you did tell me, yeah.
Using pirated software was wrong.
Yeah.
He felt he could, with a clearer conscience.
I mean, the route I went down, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Eric Fromm and whatever. He wrote a book called The Art of Loving, which isn't what it sounds.
What?
where he talks about, you know, art being a skill that you have to... love being a skill that you have to practice. It's like an art that you have to work towards. And this is love in the sense of agape or brotherly love. And so the idea that people are building this stuff together and developing their skills, you know, to communicate them, to work together, is something that's so fundamentally human and defines us. But compared to, you know, the consumerist market economy we live in, where we define ourselves by, you know, what we buy and what we own, free software is doing something genuinely cool and building a different vision of what it is to be human.
That's the best way to end a podcast. What it means to be human, brotherly love. That's it. See you in a few weeks, folks.
Many, many other good points.
That was an awesome
point. That was probably the most awesome point.
It feels
that was like 3 months of my life, though.
It does. But
let's go down the pub.
But definitely, if you've not already done so, look back over the points on Tux Radar, because there's so much variety and it just
gets, it's really good actually. It was really great, the response.
It's great to show that, you know, there's no, you know, one or two things that people have rallied around. There's
everyone's
such
different.
A variety of choice.
And I agree with almost all of the points made as well. It makes you realise just how much positivity and how much great things there is and how many great things there are in Linux.
Well, apart from Prolific Puffin, who says Mike Saunders is Linux's killer feature.
That's brilliant.
But he's just obviously wrong.
Isn't that an anagram for Mike's dad, I think?
How do you know my dad isn't called Prolific Puffin? And with such fun, we come to the end of the podcast. Have you got one more thing, Graham? You can read out some...
Oh, damn, yeah. Is that what I'm supposed to do?
You can read out some Frontier statistics if you want.
Right at the bottom.
Oh, okay. How many lines of code do you think, how many lines of 68K assembly code do you think make up Frontier? And Mike obviously knows the answer because he's just handed me the one more thing that he carefully crafted and put together.
I just knew anyway because it's just all in my head.
Not many, but 20,000?
You reckon, John?
I have no idea, like 4,000, something ridiculously small.
Well, I mean... On the Amiga, it was a couple of floppies. So is that about 2 meg or 3 meg of assembly code?
Well, yeah, the main game executable was 800 kilobytes.
Right. So that's still quite a lot.
Yeah.
It's 250,000 lines, according to Mike's notes.
250,000 lines of, of 68K assembly language code that David Braben wrote. Because most of the game is code. There's little in the way of bitmaps or tunes. It's all code and logic and engines.
How many lines in MicOS?
MicOS is between 4,000 and 4,500 lines of code at the moment, and that's
amazing.
It's unbelievable what he's done.
How long would that take to write?
Four years.
Yes.
So according to Mike's notes.
Four years he spent writing it, yeah.
Yep, and as Mike's written down here, still fitted onto a floppy disk. What, an 800K floppy disk?
Well,
760K?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, the main binary was the only thing on the first floppy.
What is this? 513,982,470 unique star systems.
Yeah.
How
over
many?
500 million.
500 million.
Unique procedurally generated star systems.
That's so cool. Yeah.
It must be the biggest
it's
game
very
ever.
Cool. You didn't try it out yesterday then?
No, I didn't. I've been trying to figure out gnome shell extensions and decided to quit.
Oh,
I know.
It's plenty of time. It's a normal month now. Okay, brilliant. Thanks very much, Mike. Thanks, everyone. That was a great podcast. Thank you for listening. Don't forget you can subscribe to Linux Format.
And join us on the IRC channel.
Absolutely. Tuxradio.com/subscribe. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with a bit of luck. See you then. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.